From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process with today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright on his new book, God Save Texas, and the Hulu miniseries adapted from his 2006 book, The Looming Tower.
When I write nonfiction, I'm always looking for a character who can help tell the story and communicate to the reader, you know, a particular perspective. And I call that person a donkey. The donkey is the person that you can ride into the other world and you carry a lot of information on his back.
And later we'll hear from Twin Peaks co-creator Mark Frost on the cult television series Return to Air after 25 years.
For me, it put me in mind of themes like mortality and friendship over time and what really matters.
On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Multi-talented scribe Lawrence Wright has told stories as an author, screenwriter, playwright, and journalist. Last month, Wright released his highly anticipated new book, God Save Texas, which explores the history, culture, and politics of the most controversial state in America. I interviewed Wright on the day of the book's release at an event co-sponsored by Austin Film Festival and the Texas Book Festival. This is a pretty unique book in the Larry Wright Library. Your journalism is, you know, largely what seems to drive those stories, and this one came out of, you know, some other place, right? And so can you talk about, like, the idea of how that came about and why that's the structure that you chose for this book?
Yeah, it's, you know, when I was a young journalist, there was an electric fence around the first-person pronoun. When I write nonfiction, I'm always looking for a character who can help tell the story and communicate to the reader, you know, a particular perspective. And I call that person a donkey, which sounds disparaging, but it's, you know, a donkey is the person that you can ride into the other world and you carry a lot of information on his back. In this case, I realize I'm my own donkey. And it's about my experience of Texas. Let me say, you know, I love Texas. That's why we're here. But I love it enough to be critical of it. And some people have, you know, said that I've fallen out of love with Texas. I disagree with that. But I am concerned about some of the directions that we're going. At the same time, I want to express how many wonderful things there are about it. And so I travel around to all parts of Texas, talking to people that I've known in the past and meeting new people. So, you know, there's so many different, when my editor at The New Yorker asked me to explain Texas, I reminded him I get paid by the word. That's a big question you just asked me. It is an interesting structure because, you know, it is a travelogue. It is, you know, kind of a philosophical treatise. It's a piece of investigative journalism, and it's a memoir. I think, you know, the what holds it all together is that Texas itself is a mysterious entity. It's very diverse. It's got so many wonderful and some not so wonderful, but still very colorful characters that make up our population. And so it was a feast for me to be able to write about all that.
One of the chapters that I thought was really interesting was the president's chapter. You said that the liberal tradition that Johnson embodies is practically dead now. I would really love to hear what you mean by that.
Since Ann Richards lost to George Bush, the Democratic Party has been a very marginal player in Texas politics. And it's interesting because we think of Texas as being such a red state. And when I was a young man in Texas, it was blue. And California was red. You know, here are these, I think of them as being like separate strands of DNA revolving around each other but never touching. You know, LBJ, you know, he gave birth to the Great Society. And Ronald Reagan, the, you know, former governor of California, created the modern conservative movement. And it's interesting to me that, you know, the person venerated in California is LBJ, and here is Ronald Reagan. So there is a doubleness about our politics. We are right now in a very mean period in our political experience where there's not any balance. When George Bush was governor, for instance, it was, bipartisan was the word of the day. You know, that we had a Speaker of the House and the Lieutenant Governor were both Democrats, and the governor was a Republican, and there was a negotiation between them, and there seemed to be a lot of amity between the parties. That's gone entirely, and the division, this may change, it could change at any moment. You know, any election could make a profound difference in Texas politics, but the political axis is between the social conservatives, exemplified by Dan Patrick and apparently now by our Governor Abbott, and Joe Strauss, who is, you know, the business conservative, who's now stepping down. At least one wonders, you know, how much of a break there will be on the kind of mean-spirited, regressive actions that some of which came very close to getting passed in this last legislative session, and which might actually come to be laws in the next session come January. Wendy Davis made the observation that Texas is not a red state, it's a non-voting blue state, which is, I think, a very sage comment, because the population of Texas at large is far more progressive than its elected representatives would give you to believe. It's not to say that there aren't a lot of conservatives in Texas. They are. But given that Texas is now, like California, a majority-minority state, and in both states, about 40% of the population is Hispanic. California hasn't got a single statewide elected Republican, and we haven't elected a Democrat in more than 20 years. If Hispanics voted, as they do in California, Texas would resemble California quite a lot more in its politics. And I was asking Garnet Coleman, who's a state rep from Houston, who's black, about why Hispanics don't vote, whereas black Texans vote at a higher rate than whites. In the case of Hispanics, he thought it was the difference was the grape workers, the union that Cesar Chavez organized in California. And when you join a union, you become political. And because Texas is a right-to-work state, that never happened. There's another theory, though, I have. If you look at the statistics about who doesn't vote, take the ethnic thing out of it. The people that don't vote are young, poor, and uneducated. And there are an awful lot of Hispanics in that category. And right now, the Texas legislature is doing everything it can to keep them in that category. It's one thing to try to create voter ID cards and so on, but to keep people from getting access to kind of education that would fully enfranchise them as citizens in our state, I think that's our main problem. And the real reason that Texans don't vote is they're disenfranchised and they are disillusioned.
You have a chapter called More Sausage. In it, you're describing a grueling day at the last session. And you said, I wonder if minds are ever changed in these kinds of hearings.
Well, what you're referencing is, you know, there were several bills, but most conspicuously the Sanctuary Cities bill and the bathroom bill, that elicited this immense outpouring of public outcry. It's fascinating to see, you know, the Capitol Rotunda lined up with people all the way up to the top, you know, waiting to get in at 3 a.m, but I couldn't detect that any votes were changed. It seemed to be a strictly pro forma cosmetic exercise and just wait, let's get through all this so we can take our vote, which is already predetermined. And I don't know if that is because they're not receptive to those passionate personal stories about people who are personally, you know, their lives are being ripped apart by some of this legislation. Or, you know, is it strictly a political gambit that if I vote for this, if I vote against this bill, or it'll put me in political trouble and I'll lose, you know, then I think I think there's some of both of that. There's a lack of empathy, and then there's strictly pragmatic politics. This bill isn't going to kill me if I vote for it, so I'm not going to support it.
Let's talk about Looming Tower a bit, because obviously it's your Pulitzer book and, you know, huge bestseller. So I've been watching the show on Hulu and really enjoying it, and but also getting depressed a little bit just because it's such a manifestation of something that I think a lot of us, you know, kind of wanted to forget. You know, I want to hear from you how that came about and how you decided to approach that process, knowing that that's such a touchy subject for the general American public.
Well, you know, over the years, a number of people approached me about optioning the book and for a movie or a television show or something, and I was cautious about it because 9/11 is a sort of hallowed subject, and it needs to be treated with dignity and care. So I never really went anywhere with it. And then it became clear that somebody was going to do something, whether I liked it or not, and, you know, using essentially material from my book. And I thought, well, I better take control of this. So I hooked up with my friend Alex Gibney, who's a documentarian. We worked together on Going Clear, our Scientology documentary, and also did a one-man show called My Trip to Al-Qaeda, which Alex did into an HBO documentary. And he's a stand-up guy. He and I hired a showrunner, Dan Futterman, who had written Capote and Foxcatcher and got Academy Award nominations for both of them. So we went out to Hollywood with a chip on our shoulder. Instead of trying to make a pitch, we came with a list of demands. For one, that we would have control over it, that the studio wouldn't back down under legal threats, and that they actually make it, not develop it. And Hulu called our bluff. They agreed to all our terms. Afterwards, we went to dinner and did you ever watch Hulu? You know, we didn't really know quite much what it was, because back then they didn't have Handmaid's Tale or any of that, but we made a wonderful choice. What caused me to be especially interested in doing this is that I began to run into young people for whom 9/11 is not a part of their lived experience. You know, kids that are going into college now weren't born when 9/11 happened. So they don't know why they live in the America they do. They don't know why we've been at war, in the longest war in our history. They don't know why we invaded Iraq. They don't know why we tortured people and all this stuff. They don't understand why they live in the America that we have now. Because modern history in our country really starts with 9/11. And they also don't know that it could have been prevented.
For On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with author and television creator, Lawrence Wright. In 2006, Wright released the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, which explored the events that led to the September 11th terrorist attacks. Earlier this year, Wright teamed with his frequent documentarian collaborator, Alex Gibney, and filmmaker Dan Futterman to adapt the book into a Hulu miniseries of the same name. The show stars Jeff Daniels and Peter Sarsgaard. Clips of The Looming Tower, courtesy of Legendary Television and Hulu.
The CIA was aware that Al-Qaeda was in America. The two hijackers that would become hijackers landed in Los Angeles in January of 2000 and then went to San Diego and became a part of the cell that eventually struck the towers and the Pentagon. And in March of 2000, the CIA knew that, but they withheld that information from the FBI, which was actively seeking these very people. Had they cooperated, I think that whole plot could have been stopped. And it haunts me to think that you could roll back history. You could take away the Afghan war. You could take away the torture. You could take away the Iraq war. You could, all those things could be taken out of our history if only there had been that cooperation between those two agencies. There may never be a judicial accounting for anybody that was responsible for those decisions, but in some way, I think that there is a kind of accounting by doing this show and showing people how it happened, where we failed, and in some ways, what America was before.
If you state your name and place of employment for the record.
Special Agent Ali Soufan, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Date and place of birth?
July 8th, 1971, Sidon, Lebanon.
Agent Soufan, you testified in preliminary session that the CIA withheld intelligence from the FBI on multiple occasions. Intelligence that would have prevented the attacks of September 11th.
Yes, sir. I did.
What you're saying is contrary to CIA testimony.
All right.
So you're telling us they've lied to this commission?
If members of the CIA testified that the agency properly shared information with the Bureau in the manner in which they are, by law, directed to, then you've been lied to.
Well, one of the episodes that really kind of caught me off guard and is the episode about the little boy who ends up being on the boat that blows up the coal, but how you chose to portray that. I mean, I don't want to have any feeling for these people. You know, it's not like Tony Soprano. I would like them not to be positively thought of, but the reality is they're people too, you know, and that what I thought was interesting about that perspective in the show was how you used this camera to really introduce some of these people who were involved, that little boy in particular who was in the Osama bin Laden camp. And so how did you all make choices of how to shoot this? I'm sure Alex Gibney is a big part of it, but in trying to develop these as more characters and less just white hats versus black hats, you know?
I wonder if it would have been possible to make this series sooner, because the reaction you have about not wanting to see the human side of people who are terrorists and are in Al-Qaeda is common. My thinking is that 9/11 is a huge unresolved issue in our lives. You can't have resolution unless you have understanding. That's one of the reasons that we look in the Al-Qaeda community and try to depict them as they really were. I interviewed one of the children that had been in the Al-Qaeda camp when we bombed it after the embassy bombings in 1998. It was from that idea that we generated the notion that we would follow one of the children and take him to Yemen, a fictional child. But there was a connection between the embassy bombings in East Africa, which happened in August of 1998. And then it happened, you know, to coincide with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, or I should say the Bill Clinton scandal, and the Monica Lewinsky happened to be a part of. But it reminds me so much of our current time, when we're so distracted, you know, really important things are happening in the world, and there are tremendous perils that we're facing or refusing to face because of these Stormy Daniels type of distractions. It reminds me so much of that particular era. One of the things that persuaded me to do this series is that television changed. You know, when I wrote that book, you know, this form of these, you know, long episodic, we got 10 episodes to tell one part of the book. It was shot in 8 countries and great stars, you know, Jeff Daniels and Alec Baldwin and people like that. It was wonderful to be able to put all that talent to use in the service of a story that I think is so meaningful and important to American people.
So I'm going to ask you now about Going Clear. Because I remember running into Swedish Hill one day and seeing you and your coffee club out there, and I asked you a question about how's the book going, and you talked, the next 10 minutes was about lawyers. Lawyers. And so it seemed to be at a pivotal point. And then, in all honesty, when it wasn't long until the book came out, but then when the book came out, and then I saw y'all were doing a TV show about it, I thought, oh my God, there's got to be more lawyers now. So what made you decide to take that into that doc series on HBO and how you chose to do it? Because that was also really unique.
When I first decided I was going to write about Scientology, I knew I was in for trouble because they have a, you know, reputation well earned for attacking people that are trying to find out what's going on inside those doors. Speaking of those doors, I just got to say, remember the Scientology building on the drag? They're renovating it, I think, but when the movie, the documentary came out, some woman came out of the theater and she was so stirred up, she drove her car through the glass doors and then it didn't stop. She kind of cruised around inside the, and I had to issue a statement condemning violence. But the reason for the lawyers is that you have to be very judicious in your language when you're dealing with such a litigious organization. And so you'll find that there are very few adjectives and adverbs in that book, because I could envision myself on the stand having to defend something like the word very. Maybe I don't want to defend that word. You just don't modify it. You just, leave the nouns and verbs in place. And so it's a kind of sparsely dressed manuscript. But I loved writing that. It's a great story. And I was fortunate that there was so much threat around it that I figured I could find a way to write about it. And we had, innumerable threats. I figured if we just were careful enough, and they never did follow through on any of those legal threats that they made against the New Yorker, or against Knopf, or against HBO, or against me or Alex individually.
Well, so did you have a problem getting all of those people to actually, it's one thing to be in a book, it's another to get up there and actually tell your story in front of a camera and be on television. So how did that process work, getting people to get up and talk about this?
The main challenge is that Scientology has a reputation for being really vindictive, especially to its apostates, the people that have left the church. So finding people who would talk was the main challenge. But my strategy was always to try to talk to as many people as I can, because the more people you talk to, the more emboldened other people feel. And so it was, and that was even a part of my strategy. I would suggest, if so-and-so talks, will you talk? And then, go to the other person, so they'll talk if you talk. And so there is that, we're holding hands as we jump off the cliff feeling. But it started a movement, I guess a kind of rebellion that was already brewing inside the ex-Scientology community. And they became strong enough to give voice to their fears and tell the stories of their often shocking stories of persecution and abuse and imprisonment by the church. These are human rights abuses that I don't know why our government hasn't dealt with them. But that once again, this is a place where the only court of opinion is in journalism. And, so that at least we've gotten the story out there.
So we're sort of in a Larry Wright perfect storm right now. You've got your book coming out today. You have Looming Tower on currently, new episodes coming up. And then, of course, Cleo is being produced, your play about Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, a couple I will never understand, that got moved to now because of the hurricane. So can you talk to us about how tired you might be right now?
I am a little fatigued. I have been, and I'm sick of hearing myself talk. I do want to talk a bit about Cleo and the Alley Theater. The Alley is a beautiful old theater. Actually, it's kind of formidable on the outside. It looks like some old Venetian fort or something. But inside, it's just a gorgeous spot. And my actors were already down there in the end of August when they were getting costume fittings when Harvey hit. And I was scheduled to go down the day the hurricane arrived. And I was able to navigate. John Burnett forged a trail down there, and I followed him a couple of days later. And I could see, you know, the main stage was above the waterline, but everything, there was another stage below ground, and then below that, the utilities, the electrical closet, 100,000 props from their 20 decades, you know, that they've collected, all of it totally underwater. I mean, there was a stairway, and I went down like three steps, and there was the water. And it took 10 days to drain it. I thought, this is not going to happen. So I was rehearsing with the cast. And, you know, a lot of people at the Alley, you know, their homes were destroyed or damaged. And so his theater was really, really suffering. And the artistic director came to one of our rehearsals. And I was directing because Bob Balaban was the director, and the airport was still closed. And the artistic director came in and said, you know, they were canceling the production. And the actors said, yeah, well, we just want to keep rehearsing. I said, didn't you hear the guy? You know, you can go home now. He says, you know, there's no production. But anyway, the artistic director began to weep. There's a big difference between journalists and actors, I can tell you right now. And it's a community that I cherish, but I don't understand. And anyway, the next day he came back, they had torn up their schedule and they found a place for us in April. So for that reason, Cleo, which I've been working on for 20 years, has finally found a home. And the quality, neither Bob nor I nor anybody in the cast has ever seen the quality of the production that we're getting. The costumes and the sets and stuff like that are above Broadway quality.
Well, so 20 years of working on a marriage that didn't last the five times it occurred or whatever, 20 years, did it? So you've spent more time on that play than they spent with each other, maybe.
Oh, right? much more. but you have to realize that this scandal, which took place in 1962, happened to coincide with the onset of puberty for me. And so it made a real impression. Back then, in TV and movies, married couples slept in twin beds. It was a very prim, you know, world, and especially seen from the perspective of Dallas, Texas. And then suddenly the sheets are ripped off, and there is this scandal with the most famous woman in the world. You can't realize how famous Liz Taylor was. It was really the birth of the sexual revolution. And the Pope condemned her. There was a resolution in Congress to keep her from returning to America. Imagine that happening to Angelina Jolie. Nobody would care, you know, but back then it was just, you know, it was a scandal for the ages. And later, you know, when I was considering things I wanted to write, I realized here are Liz and Dick playing Antony and Cleopatra, you know, the greatest sex scandal of ancient history. And I thought there would be an interesting kind of dramatic parallel to explore. So the characters are Eddie Fisher, Rex Harrison, and Joe Mankiewicz, who is the director, in addition to Liz and Dick.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Mark Frost started his career as a staff writer on the celebrated 1980s police procedural Hill Street Blues. In 1990, Frost partnered with filmmaker David Lynch to co-create the television series Twin Peaks. The show's mix of melodrama, surrealism, offbeat humor, and horror was quickly celebrated for being unlike anything else on network television. In 2017, the series returned to air 25 years after its initial run for an 18-episode limited series on Showtime Network. I spoke with Mark Frost about revisiting old creations at the Austin Film Festival in 2017.
Now that I've watched the first season, the second season, the movie, read your book, and now the new season, I think the first question that came to my mind is, What the hell is going on in your head and in David Lynch's?
Well, I can only speak to mine. It's so funny. It started out with ABC coming to us in 1988 and saying, we'd really like you to try to do a nighttime soap. And they actually forced us to sit down and watch the original movie of Peyton Place. Has anybody here seen it? It's not very good. And I think we lasted maybe 20 minutes. And we just got up and said, okay, turn that off, turn that off. Mm-hmm. That was David's voice. I'm doing David's voice. So we said, we're not doing that. And then it morphed into what it became. And then it's just kept morphing until it became this latest thing. And, you know, you guys tell me what you thought of it.
Well, and I think that's takes me perfectly into the next question, which is you had a lot of time for reflection there, you know, which may become the norm for other shows now that the cable world, I mean, that has gone into the digital world and that people will pick up content that was popular in the past. But what did that time of reflection do for your re-looking at what you had already done and how to present something new and different? And it was distinctly new and different, you know?
Well, I think what 25 years allows you to do is mature and grow into whoever you're going to be and to think, I think, more interesting thoughts as you get older and to feel more interesting feelings. And you get to deal more specifically with one of the great themes of any artistic endeavor, and that's the passing of time, this sense that we're trapped on this conveyor belt that's just going in one direction. It's something we all share. It's really the baseline of human experience is that we're not going to be here forever. So for me, it put me in mind of themes like mortality and friendship over time and what really matters. And then we had the opportunity to go back and look at this very large set of characters and see what had happened to them and what their lives had done to or for them. And then wrap it all in a larger context. That was really my big objective. I said, we've got to get out of the town. We've got to enlarge the scope of the canvas, and we've got to make this about more than just this sleepy, creepy little hamlet. We want to make it a little bit more about contemporary life. So it afforded us a chance to take that kind of leap. And I think that was the most salutary thing about The Gap.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Twin Peaks co-creator Mark Frost. When we left off, Frost was discussing how 25 years of reflection led to the cult television series Return to the Air. Frost co-created Twin Peaks with award-winning filmmaker David Lynch. Known for his surrealist visuals and nonlinear narratives, Lynch's feature films include Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, and Eraserhead. Clips of Twin Peaks, courtesy of Lynch Frost Productions, Inc.
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th. Entering the town of Twin Peaks. 5 miles south of the Canadian border, 12 miles west of the state line. I've never seen so many trees in my life. As W.C. Fields would say, I'd rather be here than Philadelphia. 54 degrees on a slightly overcast day. Weatherman said rain. You get paid that kind of money for being wrong 60% of the time. It'd be working. The mileage is 79,345. Gauge is on reserve. Riding on fumes here. I got to tank up when I get into town. Remind me to tell you how much that is. Lunch was $6.31 at the Lamplighter Inn. That's on Highway 2 near Lewis Fork. That was a tuna fish sandwich on whole wheat, slice of cherry pie, and a cup of coffee. Damn good food. Diane, if you ever get up this way, that cherry pie is worth a stop. Okay. Looks like I'll be meeting up with the Sheriff Harry S. Truman. Shouldn't be too hard to remember that. He'll be at the Calhoun Memorial Hospital. Guess we're going to go up to intensive care and take a look at that girl that crawled down the railroad tracks off the mountain.
Well, I mean, what are the challenges for you of writing with such... that's, you know, as a storyteller yourself, and having done that forever, and he is too, you know, he's a writer as well, but he's such a visual. Like, how do you work that partnership of writing with somebody who's already got a sense of that in the story while you're doing it?
Well, in an instance like that, it's we talk about it back and forth, and then when I see a look come over his face, and I know that he's visualizing, and he starts to say that what he's seeing. When that happens, I try to put it into words, because that then becomes the template for whoever is going to help him create those images. So it's helpful not only for him, but for the other artists he's going to work with. One of the things that he's masterful at is creating mood on screen. Mm-hmm. He's got complete command of the medium visually and orally. I think that he can create moods like nobody in my mind since Hitchcock.
So it's not a linear journey.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that process? Because I think most stories we're used to hearing as a culture are linear. You know, they're kind of, there's this happened, then this happened, then that happened, you know. And in this case, the first couple of episodes, I have to admit, maybe it was only me, but I was like, what the heck? I don't know where this is going the next episode that's coming up, and I don't know what happened. And how did that fit into your plan for the whole season?
My words to David at the beginning were, I don't think this is necessarily a TV show or a movie. It's, we're going to be filming every page of a novel. And novels have the luxury of beginning more slowly sometimes. It isn't, you have to grab the audience by the throat in the first 35 seconds or you've lost them. It's, let's take our time. It's a value that's been almost lost in our culture. Good stories take time. We had so many characters we needed to reintroduce, reincorporate. There were so many other elements of the Cooper story that we needed to track and follow. I've likened it to Lewis and Clark trying to explore the Missouri. And there's a lot of streams and tributaries. They're going to go up and come back down and realize that's not the main channel. But interesting things can happen on all those tributaries. If you read their diaries, really interesting things happened almost every time they left the main river.
Well, so the first show had more of a traditional television structure as far as writer's room and different directors that did some of the episodes. And this one was pretty much you and David. Can you talk about why you made that decision to really have it just be the two of you for the most part, and what issues that presented for you?
Number one, we started talking in August of 2012. We talked for almost a year before we ever wrote a word. Just to hash all this out, figure out who, what, when, where, why. Then we started writing. I think it helped a lot that in the intervening years, I had begun and continued a career as a novelist. Mm-hmm. So I'm used to a longer, more complex narrative. That's what appeals to me. And David was absolutely firm about, I want to do all of it. I want to direct all of it if we're going to do it this way. And we both said, well, then no one else should write any of this. We're going to have to do it ourselves. So we ended up 3 years later with a 450-page script that we didn't even break down into episodes. Oh. And we handed Showtime this Manhattan phone book and said, try to get back to us by Monday. So there's something to be said for doing things in an unusual way. You can get people's attention sometimes. by doing that. The only other person who ever saw the completed script was Kyle. Every actor was given only their pages. No context about when or where those scenes were going to play in the fabric. So it made for a pretty interesting set because no one really knew how it was going to work for them. And we just asked everybody, this time take a leap of faith. Let's just go on this journey together and see what happens.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, when you were going through this process with David Lynch of just a year of talking about it, what were those conversations like that got you to a place where, now you have this foundation of what the story is going to be to develop those episodes into that 450-page script? And, was that part of it, this concept of evil?
Yeah, I mean, thematically, that was obviously a big part of the first go around. And but again, that it was a different time and place. It was a more, frankly, innocent time than the one we're living in now. And it was more focused specifically on the town and all the lovable eccentrics that populate the town. Honestly, a lot of the things that informed the discussions for that first year were the global meltdown of 2008-2009. The reason Vegas came to mind for me was these images of all these vast tract housing developments that had been built in the anticipation of this endless boom and were then abandoned. They were like ghost towns, but they were like three-year-old ghost towns. I'd never seen that on screen up to that point, and I thought, well, there's an image to work with. So along with evil, there's themes like the perils of materialism. If you live a strictly material life, what happens if the money runs out? What are you left with? That led to the evolution of Dr. Jacoby into Dr. Amp, the internet ranter who sells golden shovels for $29.99. That's 2012. We started shooting in September of 2015, and we finished in April of 2016. Most people didn't know what was going to come at the end of 2016 and what we're living with now. But there were overlaps between the concerns that we'd created in response to that first crash to the situation we have now. So I think it resonated culturally more than you could hope for. And that's just the sort of thing you get lucky with. I mean, you never know. You can't anticipate those things with this kind of lead time. The idea that we were going to focus more on Agent Cooper specifically this time around, that this was going to be his journey. And honestly, I went back and started looking at or thinking about sources like The Odyssey. Mm-hmm. This is about a guy trying to get back to who and what he thought he was, that he's been like Odysseus, been cast on some foreign shore and has sort of lost his sense of himself. And we all feel that to some degree or another at various times in our lives. And how do we deal with it? Mm-hmm. And in his case, how does he reunite himself? How does he pull himself back together? So in thinking about an overall thread for the story, that was it. It was the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. It was him finding his way home. If you want to talk more thematically, you're stripping a character down to the nub. You're making him a baby again. And then he's got to relearn a whole new way of being. Look, from a psychological standpoint, you can say, okay, this is a story about a guy who had never integrated his shadow self. I'm a Jungian. I believe in that stuff. David's not psychological. He doesn't even want to hear about it. But to me, that's what that story is about. And Dougie just cracked us up.
Huffy.
Sorry, Dougie. I didn't get one for you. I didn't know if you'd be here today.
Huffy.
You can have Frank's. He never drinks his anyway. And I got extra green tea. Maybe he'll like that, huh?
It was so much fun to write Dougie. And that little thing we'd given him of repeating those last few lines, to come up with the right line to get him to say the right thing. And honestly, Kyle's performance is flawless. One of my favorite scenes ever is having breakfast to Take Five and watching Dougie discover these things for the first time. My feeling was we needed an origin story for the evil that we have been depicting in this area. I had mentioned the atomic bomb and White Sands and what if something like this happened? And it, again, it's all metaphorical, but what if something ripped a hole in the space-time continuum and it unleashed some, it opened Pandora's box. Let's go back to Greek mythology. And things unanticipated and strange came out of the box, just like in the myth. So we wrote that. We wrote, I think the whole sequence is 12 pages. And David started to get some very clear visualizations of what, how he wanted to depict, for instance, the explosion itself. And we wrote, I think, a half a page describing it. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, well, that's going to be about 8 minutes of screen time, knowing David as I do. And sure enough, it was 12, I think. We said, that's how the woodsman got here. And this creature that you see being born and crawling into the mouth of that young girl is the origin of the evil we've been dealing with for 27 years. And I thought it was an extraordinary hour of television. I mean, because we, what was interesting in structurally, the week before we had done maybe the most Twin Peaks old style episode. There were a lot of nice payoffs and introductions and things that made you feel like, okay, now I'm back in Twin Peaks. And then you get hit with this gut punch of an hour. So that's how it started, and that's what it was meant to convey.
I'm going to go back to a little bit of the story from your perspective. I mean, if you were sort of summing up again what you wanted this all to be about, and not necessarily just for the audience, but for yourselves, can you talk a little bit about what you guys were trying to?
Well, thematically, for me, it was this is the human condition. Life is strange, puzzling, funny, absurd, bizarre, tragic, horrifying, hilarious. And when you've got a chance to do an 18-hour story, and by the way, along the way, a lot of the friends that you had making the show the first time around aren't with you anymore. The passage of time, again, the sense of mortality, the importance of friendship, the void created by loss, all of those things became germane to the storytelling. And again, that's that Lewis and Clark metaphor. It's like, okay, well, that's we need to follow that up. Just to pull one example out, the Big Ed and Norma story, which we really wait pretty deep into the story to conclude, but we dole out little bits and pieces of it along the way. And then you get that devastating shot of Ed eating his soup alone at the gas station. And it goes on for like 2 minutes. Just a man eating soup. And it's honestly one of the saddest scenes I've ever seen. And then, of course, you know, with that story, you get a much happier ending. So whenever you come across a piece of the story that you really like, you take your time and you tell it fully. Like, I was determined. I said, we've got to meet Andy and Lucy's son. And it's probably only going to be one scene, but it should be a full scene. And I think David said, and Michael Cera should play him. To me, that's one of the, I know that scene rubs some people the wrong way, but I would watch it every day for 2 weeks and be very, very happy. Wally Brando.
Well, so in the first iteration, you have this show that comes out of nowhere. And of course, we lived in a different world then. There were, what, three networks when that came out? Not even Fox at that point. Fox, yeah. And so three networks were there, and you've got a world where people were just totally gut punched. You know, they were like, wow, I wasn't expecting this. What is this show? Yeah. And weren't you a part, like, mid-season?
We came out in the spring.
Uh-huh. So it was only really half a year.
Yeah.
The first season.
It was so funny because they saw the pilot. It was a very peculiar process because we did the pilot. They saw the pilot. They didn't know what to make of it, mm-hmm. but it tested really well, but they were terrified. And they said, okay, well, maybe you can just make 7 more. So that was the first season. So we did all that in a vacuum. No one had ever seen it. So we had it's the 2-hour pilot and then 7 additional hours. It was 9 hours. And they said, okay, well, we really want to put it on at like 2 a.m. and, you know, just in Poughkeepsie on Access Cable Channel. But we're going to have to put it on the network in April. And then, you know, this reaction blew up in their face. And I mean, if you look at that pilot again, what's startling about it is how real the grief is. The whole first hour is just about the discovery of the death of this young woman and these very real, very powerful reactions by good actors showing you how devastated they are. I mean, I was kind of stunned when I saw it again. Nothing funny happens for quite a while. You know, when Cooper comes to town, you start to roll with that, and as he starts to meet the town, then it gets funnier. But honestly, the pilot and really that whole first season is about grief. And no one had depicted grief on TV like that before. That's why we would get a lot of nervous laughter about it. When Grace would, who's an amazing actress, was actually wailing and keening like a character out of Greek mythology. I think that's what caught people. There was an authenticity about it. And anybody who's lived in a small town or knows, has strange friends, and we've all met colorful, weird, eccentric characters. This town just happened to have a few more of them than, you know, maybe the general population. But that all kind of blended together. Mm-hmm. You know, you can make plans initially, but until you get there, and that happened a long time after we first thought of it, when we finally finished writing, you know a lot more. So you're then making decisions based on where you are in the journey. It's not like, you know, you set off from port here and you know exactly what it's going to be like. Conditions change, winds change, new ideas come to you, and that's where you are at the end. Again, I always go back to mythology. This is the story of Persephone. It's the story of Orpheus. It's Orpheus. And when you tempt the gods or when you break the rules, you put yourself in grave moral and physical peril. And I think that, for me, is the best way to explain the final hour of the show. It's an act of hubris to think that you can change history and change the flow of time. That's for the world of the gods, not for the world of mortals. Thematically, for me, that was of a piece with everything else we'd done.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.